For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys.
Listen to Stories from the Pacific on your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Iorana maloni, aloha kako, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, PNG proposes a 10k buffer zone along its land border with Indonesia as a no-go area for military or government personnel.
Is that zone going to be 10 kilometers into PNG, or is it 10 kilometers into Indonesia, or is it going to be 5 kilometers on each side? What we have to also recognize is that PNG Defence Force alone doesn't have the capacity to monitor that whole border.
And there's calls for an upgrade to the famous World War II Kokoda track in PNG as visitor numbers decline, causing loss of jobs for the locals.
The young blokes can walk the track, but what about the mothers at home? What about the young youths? How can they benefit? Especially along the Kokoda track, there's no other income.
It's cyclone season for the region, so how can we best be prepared?
And that's it. American Samoa can celebrate. They're going through to the second round of the Oceania qualifiers. What a wonderful performance from them.
You heard right. For the first time ever, American Samoa's national women's soccer team through to the second stage of the FIFA World Cup. All that and more, but before we start, we'd like to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Aggie Thubol. Ko rabua. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, Australia, PNG and Indonesia will today hold their first ever Defence Ministers meeting, just a few months after Canberra signed landmark security agreements with both Jakarta and Port Moresby. Meanwhile, PNG's Defence Minister, Billy Joseph, says that he wants to set up a buffer zone on the border of PNG and Indonesia's restive West Papua province. And Australia's Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, has used a speech in Canberra to burnish the government's Pacific credentials while warning about the risks caused by China's military build-up. Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jejitz joins us now with the latest on all of this. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Aggie.
Yeah, let's get straight into it. Gosh, what's the significance of this trilateral meeting today? I mean, I'm wondering, what is its genesis and where did the idea for this come from?
Well, Aggie, this seems to have come from the discussions that Australia and Papua New Guinea were holding with Indonesia when they were negotiating the Puk-Puk Treaty, the landmark defence treaty that was signed just a couple of months ago. Also, of course, worth remembering that Australia and Indonesia have also signed their own security agreement. In fact, that happened only a month or so after Australia signed the agreement with Papua New Guinea. Mm. So The Albanese government has not exactly been idle here when it comes to building up these agreements in the region. So, of course, Australia and PNG were very conscious in the lead up to this announcement that they would have to tread carefully with Indonesia. Indonesia is always wary of any foreign interference whatsoever. It's particularly wary if it touches at all on anything to do with West Papua, the restive province where Indonesia faces essentially an ongoing insurgency, or at least a low-level insurgency. So given PNG shares a long land border with West Papua, something we'll discuss shortly as well, Australia and Papua New Guinea were keen to keep Indonesia informed and to reassure them that there was nothing being contemplated by this defence treaty that would pose any sort of threat to Indonesia. Now, that seems to have largely worked, although Indonesia has still publicly made it clear that there are at least some in the Indonesian system that have reservoirs of doubt about this agreement, or at least a little bit wary of it. And it seems that this idea of a trilateral defence ministers meeting was set up in part because it would provide a really useful mechanism for transparency for Australia and Papua New Guinea to explain to Indonesia exactly what they were doing, what this security treaty would mean. If they were doing joint exercises, you know, they could explain exactly where they would be and how they would work. It's designed in the first instance, I think, to reassure Indonesia about what the two countries are contemplating. Over the medium to long term, it could go even further, of course, building more strategic trust between all three, perhaps encouraging more trilateral engagement and military exercises between the three countries. And, of course, Australia over time hopes that it will bring a broader alignment of strategic views between Canberra, Jakarta and Port Moresby. That, however, I think is likely to be a longer term project.
Yes, Stephen, I mean, on the buffer proposal, right, with Indonesia and PNG, I mean, just how exactly would this work?
Well, all we've got to go on at the moment is a statement that the Minister for Defence in PNG, Billy Joseph, has made to the ABC. It's not yet clear whether Indonesia would be interested in pursuing this at all. But nonetheless, Billy Joseph says that he is worried about the land border between PNG and West Papua. It runs more than 800 kilometres, so it's a very large area. And of course, as a number of people have pointed out, you know, we have seen a fair flow of people, but also weapons across that border. And as we know, the conflicts that we've seen in the highlands of PNG are also in some ways connected to that flow of weapons, potentially in both directions. So this is something that obviously Billy Joseph is concerned about. The way he's sketched it out is basically, look, we'll set up a buffer zone between the two countries. He's suggesting it would be about 10 kilometres along the border in width. He's saying it would be a no man's land that would be free from military infrastructure. But then within that, both TNI, the Indonesian National Forces, and the PNGDF can man effectively joint patrols or police that no man's land. So he says, quote, that's the sort of close collaboration we want to see with Indonesia. Now, you know, that would, he would hope, you know, make sure that some of the unrest that we're seeing in West Papua doesn't bleed across the border. Whether Indonesia is willing to contemplate that, given the enormous sensitivities in Jakarta around this issue, and given the fact that things are still pretty grim in West Papua, we haven't seen the same violence very recently that we've had in recent years, but all of the signs, you know, continue to point that the fact that the Indonesian government's attempts to really bolster economic growth in the province are not really working, and large numbers of people in West Papua clearly still hanker very much for independence, something that Indonesia is simply not willing to grant. So it's not yet clear whether Jakarta's willing to look at this, but it's very interesting and noteworthy that this is being proposed, and particularly interesting that it's being proposed on the eve of this big trilateral meeting with Australia, Indonesia and Papua New Guinea. It'll be interesting to see what Australia makes of this idea too.
That's right. Well, I mean, look, meanwhile, the foreign minister actually used a speech to lay out the government's Pacific strategy. Was there anything that sort of jumped out at you?
Yeah, a couple of things. This is a pretty detailed speech from the foreign minister at an event given by the Kokoda Track Foundation in Canberra last night. Much of it did go over, I guess, fairly familiar ground, talking about what the federal government, what the Australian government is trying to do in the Pacific. But it was still a useful and very substantive statement about the broader strategy the government's bringing to bear. Unsurprisingly, given the world we're in at the moment, the foreign minister struck a somewhat grim tone at times, talking about the big challenges facing the Pacific, climate change, of course, at the top of that list, transnational crime, which she called a pervasive scourge in the region. But then she also wanted to make it clear that the Pacific was being buffeted by some of the trends that are hurting the globe at the moment, including rampant disinformation, foreign interference and cyber attacks. And perhaps unsurprisingly, China inevitably also came up. The foreign minister said China was continuing to assert its strategic influence, including through economic and security means, and is, quote, more frequently projecting its military power further into our region. She referred to the worrying pace of China's military buildup. And in the face of that, she said Australia was really trying to back in what she's called a Pacific first approach to security, saying that outside players need to respect sovereignty and Pacific-led approaches. And there was a pretty clear reference to China when she said that the growing interest and activity from external partners in the security of our region has had, quote, consequences, both intended and unintended. So, again, that's another clear sign from Australia that, you know, that it does not like what China is doing in the region, whether that's increasing Chinese military visits to the region or the China's push into the policing and security space in the Pacific. This is something the government sees as unwelcome and fundamentally destabilizing.
Yeah, well, speaking of that, I mean, look, it comes as the government monitors, you know, a Chinese naval flotilla in the Philippine Sea to the north, east of Papua New Guinea. Do we, Stephen, know where it's actually heading?
No, we don't at the moment. There were some interesting images released yesterday by a private intelligence firm that's managed to track down this flotilla. We first heard about its existence officially last week. And shortly after that, there was a report in the Financial Review saying that a Chinese task group was being monitored by Australia. Yesterday, the Defence Minister effectively confirmed that, saying he wouldn't give a running commentary, but confirming that they were looking at a flotilla in the Philippine Sea. Apologies, Aggie, this was actually on Monday, not yesterday. The days are blurring into one. Then yesterday, this private firm came out and released these images, which show that as of December the 1st, it was around 260 nautical miles east of the Philippines in the Philippine Sea, heading in a southeast direction. Now, the fact it's motoring to the southeast is obviously caused a bit of interest in the Australian government. It's not clear exactly where it's heading, but they're already operating well outside of the first island chain. If they continue their trajectory or the passage, then you could see a situation where it swings to the north of Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands. And obviously, you know, Australia might wonder whether it would then head further south from there onto the Australian eastern seaboard. But at the moment, this is speculation. We don't know where it's going. We don't know exactly what it's doing. We do know that it boasts some pretty formidable firepower and that it's being tracked very closely by New Zealand, Australia, and, of course, Washington as well. So we'll have to wait and see.
Absolutely. And as always, we do know you're the only one that allows us to be updated with all that is happening out there from Canberra. So thank you very much, Stephen.
No problem, Aggie. Cheers.
That is our ABC Foreign Affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts, here on Pacific Beat. Well, staying with PNG, as you would have heard, who are proposing a 10-kilometre buffer zone along its land border with Indonesia. PNG's Defence Minister, Billy Joseph, told the ABC that this was up for discussion in trilateral talks with Indonesia and Australia. He says the zone would be a no-go area for military or government personnel. Mr. Joseph says there's concerns that conflict in Indonesia's Papua region rather could spill across PNG's border. Oliver Nobendal is the project director of the Australia PNG network at the Lowy Institute and told Evan Wasuka that the talks were a first for the three countries.
The significance is the fact that it's happening for the first time and that we haven't actually had something happen earlier. Trilaterally, there hasn't been much of a connection or cooperation seen before in the past. This is the first time that we're going to see this sort of level of cooperation between all three of the countries. And I think it speaks to something that has a lot of potential. I think it's also worth noting first that Australia is going to be sort of that middle ground that both PNG and Indonesia share. Now, Papua New Guinea and Indonesia do have a defense cooperation agreement, but that level of cooperation isn't to the extent that we see each of them exercise with Australia. I've always sort of described the dynamic between PNG and Indonesia on sort of both sides of the border, that we tend to practice some form of a bit of a selective ignorance, where we don't really know much about each other, nor do we try to make a very active attempt to integrate and partner more with each other as well. Look, it's the first time this meeting is taking place, for this meeting, you know, while it's to sort of allay Jakarta's concerns around the Puk Puk Treaty, I personally would like to see this become a regular thing.
Papua New Guinea and Indonesia share land border. One of the areas of concerns raised by Papua New Guinea is about having a buffer zone, a 10-kilometer zone in between the two countries. Mm-hmm. Is this a new concept, or what's your understanding around this suggestion?
Yeah, look, I myself haven't heard of this before, but I do understand sort of the logic behind it. The questions, obvious questions that come up now is sort of saying, is that zone going to be 10 kilometers into PNG, or is it 10 kilometers into Indonesia, or is it going to be 5 kilometers on each side? It's feasible. I think what we have to also recognize is that PNG Defense Force alone doesn't have the capacity to monitor that whole border that it has with Indonesia. So this is where cooperation is definitely necessary between both of the countries. The other question as well that's sort of raised by this proposal of a buffer zone is sort of asking what the issue is that's trying to be addressed or avoided. It's not monitoring a border for the sake of monitoring a border. Like, what is it that's permeating these borders? So, you know, could it be minerals that are going into Indonesia from Papua New Guinea? PNG has had a lot of tribal fights, with like a proliferation of internal conflicts. So could this be sort of arms trade coming to PNG as well? So clarity around that would be quite helpful to understand the logic behind the sort of buffer zone idea.
What's your understanding about this particular area right now, this border between Papua New Guinea and Indonesia? Is there movement throughout between the two sides, or what's your understanding of it?
My understanding is very anecdotal, right? So I can't say that I have a deep understanding of it, but I think that's the problem. Not many people do have a clear understanding of the activities that are going on, right? Because it's an area that's not readily policed, but it's also an area that's covered by deep forests as well, and it's quite rural, for not just for Papua New Guinea, but even for Indonesia as well, to be watching. So I think there's some level of, intelligence that goes by to speak of, you know, what's happening across the border, but I can't give you a really clear picture of what exactly that would be.
Now, in terms of the trilateral talks that are taking place, what do you think are the key things that all sides need to address in terms of looking ahead?
Yeah, look, I think primarily the first concern is obviously going to be what is it that Indonesia or Jakarta needs to hear to make themselves feel comfortable with the Puk Puk Treaty that's been signed. I think both Australia and Papua New Guinea have committed fully to that, and I think getting the buy-in of its nearest neighbour, really, in this sense, is going to be quite important. So I think that should be at the top of the list. Like I mentioned earlier, I'd like to see this become a regular thing, and this hasn't really been explored in the past. But one thing that we should probably look at is how do we sort of make the three countries here form somewhat of, I guess, like a good kind of like a golden triangle, if you think about it. I think a trilateral cooperation between these three countries has the potential to add to sort of regional stability in the southern part of the Indo-Pacific theater that we've been looking at. So I think that's another key issue as well. And I don't know if it's going to come up, but I do realize from the comments that these are one of the very few times that the PNG government openly talks about West Papua as well. Now, I don't think that this is going to be a direct sort of action item from the Puk Puk Treaty, but it is interesting to note the PNG government's comments coming out talking about West Papua being an internal security issue. This position isn't surprising because Papua New Guinea has its own sort of internal secession movement, which is through what Bougainville is pushing for in terms of independence. But it's just interesting to note that the Marape government has sort of vocalized its views on West Papua.
You mentioned West Papua there. In terms of the West Papuan movements, from their perspective, looking at this idea of a buffer zone, how do you think they'd be feeling right now about this idea?
That's something that needs to be tread carefully, and the narrative sort of needs to be controlled, and the signals sent over from Papua New Guinea has to be carefully decided on. I think if it's a buffer zone where Indonesia looks after its side of the border and PNG looks after its side of the border as well, this is something that's, I think, should be amenable to both of the countries, because it just shows that, you know, we don't want any of those internal issues spilling over into PNG. that's sort of the position that seems to be taken by the PNG government. So I think just signaling that to them and, you know, not demonstrating that, oh, this is a buffer zone for us to come in and help assist with West Papua. I think it's just how they sort of manage those expectations.
And that's Oliver Nobendal, the project director of the Australia PNG Network at the Lowy Institute. He was speaking there to ABC's Evan Wasuka.
Pacific Beat.
Yes, Kokoda landowners are calling on the Kokoda Track Authority to spruce up the World War II trail to make it more enjoyable for tourists so it provides more jobs for locals. 2023 figures show a 42% decline in trekkers since its peak in 2008, with recovery efforts hindered following last year's blockade at Nauru Village. For tourists that do make it over, many raise complaints over a lack of sites, museums or interactive installations along the way. Kletus Swangiha is a veteran Kokoda tour guide and community leader, and he told Kyle Evans the lack of investment is hurting visitation numbers and costing locals jobs and opportunities.
I work as a tour guide along the Kokoda Track for the last 10, 12 years ago. At the moment, like, the Kokoda Track Authority is just catering for the corridor itself. They've been just keeping boundaries and they've been delivering, but not that much as, you know, the locals being expecting. Yeah, so what Charlie Lin is concerned about, I agree with what he's coming up with.
So what kind of things does the KTA do? How do they act in a way that you think, oh, that's not right?
Yeah, working alongside with the local members, local ward councillors, and working alongside with the local reps and leaders from each village along the Kokoda corridor and also the Kokoda township, working alongside with them, making sure they give their opinions or how they want to see the picture of the operations and how they would benefit and all that stuff.
In what ways does the local community need help at the moment? Like, it sounds like the local community's being neglected, they're not being heard. Like, what does that look like on the ground?
Along the track that they have is, like, you know, youths and young men, you know, walking the track, that's all. When they are employed as porters, that's where they get the wet stay. That's where they earn money to support their family. Apart from that, there's no other, you know, constructive ideas or constructive plans where KDA can sit down and say, okay, we're gonna organize this, and, you know, this is gonna be good for the community. So let us all do this and that, and then, you know, at least the young blokes can walk the trail. But what about the mothers in the house, mothers at home, ladies? What about the young youths? Because not all the men, all the youths are employed. You know, some of them, they are left behind. So how can they benefit? Especially along the Kokoda Track, there's no other income. All the men and all the young youths, they involve in being porters. There's some farming, I would say. If KDA have the plan of supporting those sustainable income for the community, then they will definitely, you know, at least be, they will help themselves.
And what's the situation like on the ground in a lot of these areas? Like, is there a lot of unemployment and things like that?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of unemployment. There's a lot of unemployment. When there's no employment, everybody's just stay back at home and they live their sustainable farming life, and they just been left out like that. It's only the youths, it's only the boys, it's only the, you know, they involve in tracking. And if KTA can fund open doors for other things connected to tracking, that will also involve the community to benefit, like, you know, the craft market, like culture comes in.
Yeah, so you'd like to see things like museums on the track potentially created, or installments such as old mortar stations or old munition stations or sites where old trenches and battles took place, like things like that, to sort of make it more interactive that they could benefit off potentially?
Exactly. A lot of Australians, a lot of tourists, when they come to do Kokoda Track, they just follow the tracking. They just walk the track only, and there's not much to see. I've been doing tracking for the last 15 years, and it's really sad to see them come, and then they start from Overs Corner, and then they finish at Kokoda, and That's all. And then they fly out, and then that's it. So a lot of their money, they spend a lot of their money in Port Moresby, hotels and food in the city, and then that's all.
And that there is Cletus Wangiha, a veteran Kokoda tour guide and community leader. He was speaking with Carl Evans. Just to note, the KTA and the provincial government has been contacted for comment.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
It is the first week of December, and the southern parts of the Pacific are in the middle of cyclone season. It's a time when the weather can change dramatically, without warning, often leaving a trail of destruction, as seen in recent years, like the tropical twin cyclones Kevin and Judy in Vanuatu. So, what's in store for the current cyclone season? Helping us find an answer to that question is Neville Coop from Ndraki Weather with that. Good morning, Neville.
Good morning, Aggie. How are you?
I am good. Thank you so much for joining us. As I have mentioned, you know, it's cyclone season, usually November to April. I'm just wondering, how are we actually looking for the Pacific region?
Yes, it's a good question. The Pacific has been relatively quiet the last few years, but of course we have had a couple of quite severe cyclones here and there. But overall, the actual number of cyclones, say in the last 3 years, has been lower than average, and that means people perhaps a little complacent that we haven't had, or certainly in Fiji, which is where I'm from, that we haven't seen one for a while, and so they're partly nervous that the big one must be coming, or they're partly sort of hoping that we have another quiet season. But we've already started to see things unfold that suggest that the cyclone season isn't far away. And by sort of late December, we will probably get the first of the Madden-Julian oscillation waves coming through that coincides with the right time of the year, the warmer sea temperatures, and we'll just have to wait and see what happens. But it's interesting that in the last few weeks, the Bureau of Meteorology has now declared that we do have a weak La Nina event unfolding in our part of the world, in the Pacific, and that has implications for the Pacific in terms of the number of cyclones. So we'll have to wait and see just how things unfold. It's an unusual start to the year. We've had very wet weather in a lot of places. Some places are very dry, particularly those places close to the equator.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, Neville. Look, you're saying it's relatively quiet. Of course, we all love quiet, right? We don't want to be affected by any sort of cyclones coming through the region, but that obviously leads to complacency. So because of that, like, are there areas, though, that are considered most at risk that we still should be looking out for?
Yes, so at this stage, with a La Nina, even if it's just a weak one, the focus is going to be on countries close to and west of the dateline. So we're talking here about Fiji, Vanuatu, New Caledonia, potentially the Solomons, and possibly even Papua New Guinea. And the French territories, Wallis and Futuna. So that's kind of where the focus is expected to be, given the climate background. There is a couple of complicating factors in that in Australia there's been a very significant Indian Ocean dipole event, which is sort of affecting how the weather has evolved around Australia. And we did see a cyclone, of quite a severe cyclone, Category 3, and the top end around Darwin just a week or two ago. So there's clearly everything is set for cyclone development in the western, the Indian Ocean and the Northern Australian region. It just hasn't reached the Western Pacific yet, and that's why I'm thinking the next time we see a Madden-Julian pulse come by, we may start to see things happening in the Coral Sea and eastwards towards Vanuatu. And that's, I would say, the timing of that would be around the Christmas New Year period. So that's perhaps the next time to sort of keep an eye on things. For the moment, everything's been concentrated in the Northern Hemisphere. We've seen two super typhoons go through the Philippines in a week. Back in November. We've also seen a cyclone in the an unusual cyclone in the southeastern corner of the Bay of Bengal that affected Sri Lanka, Malaysia, parts of or Sumatra and parts of Java in Indonesia. It was shocking flooding there, mostly heavy rain. It was a tropical depression more than a cyclone, although I think it was a cyclone briefly closer to Sri Lanka. But it's affected millions of people throughout the tropical parts of Southeast Asia, close to the equator, and that's been devastating for many people. So it's a kind of an odd start to the season. We didn't expect that this is how it would start, but and get to the point really. There's only one thing you can do is be prepared and be ready to respond when the threat becomes apparent.
Yes, and I do want to get into that. But before that, you know, when you are forecasting, Neville, how far ahead can you actually like predict where a cyclone will track or how strong it will be?
Knowing when the time is ripe for cyclones to form is the first part of that equation. And I've mentioned now a couple of times this Madden-Julian wave, which is an equatorial wave that travels from the west to the east around the globe, close to or over the equator. And that is a phenomena that leads to the development of active monsoons. So what you see is when a Madden-Julian wave in the atmosphere passes over your part of the world, you will see cloud, you'll see rain, and you'll see the precursors that you need to form a cyclone, like an active convergence zone, so forth. So we can sort of start to sort of narrow down when is it sort of waxes and wanes over a season. So we've had a busy period through late November. We're sort of coming out of that now into December. And so we'll probably have a month or so of where not much happens. And I'm starting to think now that the next event will probably line up around the end of December, so Christmas, New Year period. So that's the first thing we look for. The second thing we look for is once they start to develop, what time of the season is it? That tells us whether the initial precursor depression will move to the southwest or to the southeast. So then when we see one develop, who's going to be affected by that? And then in terms of how strong it could potentially get, we look at the sea surface temperatures and we look at the upper level structure of the atmosphere to see whether it's got all of the necessary outflow set up above the centre of the low pressure at the surface. And then you can start looking at how strong it's going to be. And the computer models these days are really good at giving us that information about four or five days ahead. Often you'll see the initial signs about a week ahead.
Well, talking about weather models, you know, recently we did a story about, you know, AI and its influence, you know, with how to report what the weather will be. And I think there's a new system called Edison. It's being trialled in the Solomon Islands and able to help better prepare communities. Are you in support of, you know, this type of new technology?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Anything we can do to improve the predictability of these events is got to be to our advantage. And we've been blessed, I think, by having gentleman Dr. Neil Gordon, formerly with New Zealand Met. He's retired, but he's taken up the mantle of investigating how AI can be used in computer models for weather and what advantages are offered. He's as I said, he's retired, but he's very much involved in the global community developing these models, and he's somebody I think that is a real resource for meteorologists in our part of the world. But beyond that, we have Australia and the US and other countries all looking at how AI can be used for predictability. And that's why much more now than it was when I first began my career in meteorology back in the mid-80s, the forecaster's role is not so much about trying to make a projection of where a cyclone will form and where it was going to go and how it's going to behave. We leave that to the models. Our role these days is more to do with decision making, how to get communities prepared, and that linkage between the weather forecasters and the disaster preparedness officers, and also right down to the community level, so that people are well prepared before the risk becomes to the point where not much more can be done to safeguard people. So that's really the goal. You want to have a system that protects people and minimises losses, property, lives, etc. And we'll use any tool we can get our hands on to do that.
Well, look, as we wrap up now, Neville, talking about preparation mode, what should families, our villagers, be doing now to prepare?
Well, of course, there's the standard things such as cutting back vegetation, minimising the possibility of falling trees or affecting your house, getting your village, if you live in the rural communities of the Pacific, together to clear the environment around you from potential hazards. Get your roofs and gutters and all of that sort of thing checked, and as I said, to trim back big branches of trees. Have a plan to evacuate. Where are you going to go? Where is your evacuation center? Where is your nearest location? If you're close to the coast, make sure that you have adequate means for protecting people from storm surge and such by preparing a place to seek refuge higher than the coast. Mm. But then also become familiar with how your environment is impacted. What happens if you have, for example, in a lot of places in the Pacific, you have very heavy rain associated even with relatively weak cyclones. And if you have communities by rivers, which they often are, then the rainwater coming out of the river meeting the incoming tide can cause significant flooding. And flooding is quite often the most prominent cause of loss of life or injury. So know your environment and how it interacts. For example, we're about to come to a full moon now. Mm. So the next full moon will be early in the new year, around New Year. So if we have a big event, then know, okay, it's full moon. This is how the river responds when we have lots of rainwater coming out. And what does that mean for who's safe and who's not safe?
Absolutely. Look, some really great tips and advice there, Neville, for preparing our families out there in the Pacific region. So again, thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, Aggie, and I hope everybody stays safe over Christmas, and we can all look forward to a prosperous new year.
Absolutely.
And that cyclones don't interfere with all the holiday festivities.
Of course. Neville, once again, thank you again for your time. That is Neville Coop from Nantaraki Weather here on Pacific Beat. Well, look, you've just heard about preparation for the cyclone season, but right now here's a quick recap of our show so far. PNG have proposed a 10K buffer zone along its land border with Indonesia as a no-go area for military or government personnel. There's also calls to upgrade the famous World War II Kokoda track in PNG as visitor numbers declined. And cyclone season for the region. It is definitely time to get prepared. Still to come, though, your headlines from around the region and qualifying for the very first time is American Samoa's national women's soccer team now going through to the second stage of the FIFA World Cup. That and more shortly right here on Pacific Beat.
Join Jacob McQuire and Michael Chow for Nisha Daily every weekday morning on ABC Radio Australia.
When's Emily getting a show?
Well, she kind of runs this one.
She does run this
one. I don't mind being in the background, guys. I can just roll my eyes and shake my head at all the things you say. I'm happy with that.
But you know how some places have like a swear jar? We need like an eye roll slash head shake jar for Emily.
Nisha Daily, weekday mornings from 7 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Kia ora, welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol, and I'm joined in the studio this morning with our producer, Carl Evans. We've got some headlines happening, but how are you today?
I'm well, Aggie, I'm well. It's actually my last day before I go on a couple of weeks of holidays. So, very much looking forward to that. Up on the beautiful Gold Coast.
Oh, beautiful. I have to quickly ask, what's that like, though, in the Gold Coast? I've never been.
You've never been to the Gold Coast? You know, I actually haven't been in 15 years, to be honest. So, it's all I can remember really is being a kid in theme park. And, you know, roller coasters and all the good stuff. But finally, I did see my sister sent me a video last night of her little boy, my nephew, who's only one year old, learning to swim in the exact same pool that I learned to swim in. It probably would have been, 30 years ago. Pretty surreal.
Oh, well, I know you're going to have a great time. But look, of course, we need to head back to what's happening around in the region. This one here, we started the Cook Islands. They're actually back in the headlines over its ties to oil tankers suspected of smuggling crude oil to Russia.
That's right. So more figures have come out suggesting that Russia and Iran have been using maritime Cook Islands to hide their tracks by sailing their vessels under its flag, their shadow fleet vessels, I mean. So US sanctions data, which have been analysed by the AFP, have identified 20 tankers registered in the Cook Islands that are believed to have smuggled oil, both for Russia and Iran, between 2024 and 2025. Yeah. A further 14 Cook Island flag tankers, meanwhile, have been blacklisted on a separate database of British sanctions covering the same period. Now, this isn't the first time reports like this have made headlines in recent times, Aggie, but it is the first time since the Cooks had that falling out with its closest diplomatic partner, New Zealand. So perhaps unsurprisingly, Foreign Minister Winston Peters has chosen now to speak out about this issue, and he's come out and said it's completely unacceptable and quite frankly untenable as a foreign policy divergence. Pretty strong words.
I must say, even with the maritime Cook Islands, do you think they've addressed these latest reports?
Look, Aggie, they've always harboured the same message and you know, essentially denied harbouring the sanctioned vessels. You know, while maintaining they conduct solid vetting checks and you know, they delete ships that show signs of shadow fleet involvement and things like that. I myself have questioned them multiple times, requesting interviews around this issue, but I've always been told the same thing, which is effectively, there's nothing to see here, please move along, we comply, yada, yada, yada. But look, there's a lot of evidence to suggest otherwise.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely keep our eyes and ears on that one. Okay, the Australian Federal Police, so their plans to establish a new policing mission for the Pacific. What's this about?
That's right. So the AFP will next year host the United Chiefs of Police Summit in New York City in what will be an Australian first. And according to AFP media, Commissioner Chrissy Barrett will use the address to be a voice for the Pacific Islands. Now, for context, this summit is a gathering of national police, ministers, senior government officials from 193 UN member states. And the AFP essentially want to supercharge operations to combat threats such as, you know, drug trafficking, cybercrime, and organised and transnational crime. And one of the ways they want to do that is by deploying officers on peacekeeping missions, sort of on an ongoing basis. The Australian newspaper, that is reporting that the AFP will also use these deployments as a way to counter some of the inroads China has made through policing initiatives in places such as the Solomon Islands. So, yeah, a bit to watch on that front. And obviously, there is certainly a lot of issues in the region, particularly in relation to transnational crime.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, well, finally, a lawsuit has been filed over the oil spill, which devastated a community in FSM's Chook Lagoon in September. What's happening here?
Yeah, very big story, this one. So this lawsuit was filed in the FSM Supreme Court's Chook Trial Division by a collective plaintiff group who were seeking to assign responsibility for the spill, which took place in September out of the Rio de Janeiro Maru, a big Japanese Japanese warship. And the defendants it's named are the governments of Japan, FSM itself, and the United States, along with the Japan Mine Action Service and Odyssey International, which is a company behind a local dive ship. Now, there's a lot in these documents in relation to evidence and things like that, so I won't get into them all. But essentially, the plaintiffs alleged that the oil, which contaminated the environment, damaged mudflats, mangroves, as well as fishing areas, they say that the risks were foreseeable and should have been prevented. But one of the more serious allegations is that the spill may have been involved in the deaths of four people who allegedly suffered nausea, vomiting, and a fever linked to the spill. So the plaintiff is seeking wrongful death damages on behalf of their families.
Goodness. I do have to know, though, have any of the defendants responded to the charges?
No. According to the documents provided, none of the three governments have filed a response. However, their respective embassies have all been informed. And look, I'm sure this could potentially be quite a high-profile case going forward.
We will look into that. Well, as always, Kyle, thank you so much for bringing us our news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Thank you, Aggie.
Well, to sport again, more soccer history has been made in the Rarotonga, where American Samoa's national women's team have made it through to the second stage of FIFA World Cup, qualifying for the very first time. A three-goal burst in the first half set them on the way to a comprehensive victory over the host nation Cook Islands in the deciding match of the preliminary round, adding another goal early in the second half to extend their lead and win the game 4-0. As Richard Hewitt reports, the result is a true landmark for a federation which has faced some humiliating losses in the past and always struggled against the odds on soccer's world stage.
American Samoa came into the tournament having never scored a World Cup goal, let alone won a game. But after netting three to defeat Tonga, they went one better against Cook Islands after laying on what could easily be the best ever performance by a team from the US territory.
Mafala, through it comes. Patea goes in, and American Samoa take the lead in this all-important match. Sensational finish from Morgan Patea. American Samoa lead 1-0. Manao, their captain, with a shot and it goes in. Second goal for American Samoa. Manao, the most capped player of all time for American Samoa. Paretta's waiting for it and Summers again accelerates through, just showing her pace. Links up with Mafala, who brings it around and Mafala gets it done. Third goal here for American Samoa. The Mafala sisters working in tangent to get the third goal for American Samoa. Patolo up high looking for Drago. Here comes the header. And lovely shot to the back of the net from Summers. Fourth goal here for American Samoa. Well, if there's someone that deserves a goal here, it would be Summers. She's done so much hard work. And that's it. American Samoa can celebrate. They're going through to the second round of the Oceania qualifiers. What a wonderful performance from them.
And it was the scorer of American Samoa's fourth goal, Matten Summers, who was chosen as player of the match.
This is just the first step in making history. We worked as a team and it took us a little bit to get settled into the game, but I think we just gritted it out and we played with a lot of heart.
Coach Amanda Cromwell has an Olympic gold and a World Cup bronze medal to her name, having played 55 times for the United States. She also has decades of experience coaching in the US college system and the National Women's Soccer League. But the scale of her achievement with American Samoa has really stirred her emotions.
What a day for American Samoa and these players, the federation. So many resources have been put towards putting together this team in a short amount of time. And I'm just so proud of the effort. I'm so proud of the competition. Everyone played their hearts out. What a great event. All the resources we had in performance and all the metrics we were given and everything from ice baths to yoga for the recovery, it was first class.
Cromwell's opposite number, Rhys Rucker, was in awe of his opponents, and he says his Cook Islands team have a lot to learn.
We're playing against a very good team, and it's clear that they're operating at a high level in terms of the intensity and physicality. Our girls aren't. That kind of showed today. But from minute 50 to 95... I thought we were good value, real good. And that's a credit to the girls for being extremely physically and mentally fatigued, but continuing to go.
So now American Samoa head to Honiara early next year to take on local rivals Samoa, New Zealand, and the host Solomon Islands in round two of World Cup qualifying. And based on the form they have shown in Rarotonga, Amanda Cromwell's team can't be taken lightly. Their success, built in almost no time at all, is based on casting their net wide in the search for talent overseas. The result is a squad which right now includes only three island-based players, with the rest from the United States. But the coach says that's a situation which can change over time.
It's been amazing going down that discovery with the Federation, getting everyone together that we can find that has the eligibility and the ancestry to represent the island. And some players don't know that they are eligible to represent certain countries, and that's huge. And I think because we're getting stronger, obviously, and we just qualified for stage two, now that's going to inspire all the girls on the island to, hey, look at this team, look what they're doing. And now we're going to have even more players from on the island. Just the recognition and the participation. It's all about opportunity, right? And now we have an opportunity to keep building this federation. And I'm so proud to be leading the way.
And this American Samoan team plays with a lot of flair. Amanda Cromwell says they play the beautiful game. And it's going to be fascinating to see how they rise to the challenge of competing at the next level when they kick off round two of World Cup qualifying against the Solomons on February the 27th next year.
And that's Richard Ewart reporting on the rise of American Samoa's national women's soccer team, with plenty to look forward to in 2026.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Coreni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tierney from Te Tamio Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Island Music with Rick Howe, Saturday from 12 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia. Yours in the Pacific.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Remember, you can find our stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. But our team will be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. As always, you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Up next is your news, and then coming up after that, it is Nija Daily. As always, great to hang out with you. I'm your host, Aggie Thupol, and you've been tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.